This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Jeff Looney joins me live in studio. He is an editor with the Thomas Jefferson Retirement Papers at the University of Virginia, and they are announcing the publication of Volume 7, which, Jeff, covers what time period?
Well, it takes us from the end of November 1813 all the way through the end of September 1814. And that's a period when we're right in the latter part of the end of the War of 1812.
Yeah, and I was telling you before we went on the air, I'm so ignorant about the War of 1812. I know the British were back on American soil. They burned Washington. What do we learn about this series of events through the Jefferson Papers?
Well, the last couple of volumes in this one have shown a bystander watching with an initial horror while America really kind of screws up for the first couple of years. Then he starts feeling a lot better because we're starting to win some victories, but that's all sort of rendered for naught when the British land and succeed in burning Washington in August of 1814. And Jefferson can't believe this for quite a while. He writes these letters saying, this is just another of these terrible rumors, but eventually he pretty much has to believe it.
Wow. So you didn't believe it at first. Was there a sense at the time that this was a second American Revolution? And I'm curious to Jefferson's thoughts about it. You may have to go into other volumes to answer this question, but how he made sense, how he deciphered this series of events of really what historians have said was a second American Revolution against England.
Yeah. I'm not sure he uses the term ever, but he certainly thought of it as the key moment in asserting American independence in a way that is really going to last. And he thinks of it not just as against Britain, but against Europe in general, because really the war is the culmination of the Napoleonic Wars, where both England and France are failing to recognize American neutrality. And so he thinks that we're going to ultimately have to fight them both, actually, and he's hoping we can avoid fighting them both at the same time. That manages to be avoided, but he regards it as a great success, not just militarily in our holding our independence, but in the development of domestic manufacturers, and that things will keep us from needing to rely on Europe to the extent we had before.
One of the very best Jefferson experts here in our community, Jeff Looney, is live in studio. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. Volume 7 of the Retirement Papers of Thomas Jefferson is now available and has just been published. It includes 526 unique documents that are printed in this volume and made sense of by Jeff and his team November 28th of 1813 through September 30th of 1814. So not quite a year, but amazing that there's 526 documents in this man's life. Are these all letters by and to him?
They're not all letters by and to. Some of them are documents that are intimately related with Jefferson. One of the most interesting sets in this volume are the first meetings on Jefferson's watch, shall we say, of the Albemarle Academy, which Jefferson joins this defunct Albemarle Academy, which had been created in 1803 and hadn't done anything for years. And Jefferson joins, and within a few short months, totally changes all of their plans from a sort of small local, in effect, high school. And by the time he's done with them, they're planning to start a college, and it ultimately, over a period of several years, becomes the University of Virginia, which is the culmination of his dreams.
Yeah, and so this is so exciting now. Here in the Retirement Papers, for the first time, we see the very first documents that deal with the founding of what will become the University of Virginia, and it begins with his work with what was going to be a high school, the Albemarle Academy, which, of course, only ever existed on paper. What do we learn about his interaction with this group of guys that they asked him to participate, right?
Well, that's not totally understood at this point. There's a legend that these guys were sitting around holding a meeting, and somebody looked out the window and saw Mr. Jefferson riding by and said, "Let's ask Mr. Jefferson what he thinks about this." We tend to discount that because why were they holding a meeting? They hadn't held a meeting for years and years, and I think the impetus to having a meeting was probably Jefferson. The new leader of this group was his nephew, Peter Carr, and my suspicion is that they decided to hold a meeting after private conversations between Jefferson and Carr. Certainly, Jefferson quickly joins the board, and within a short time, he's written a long letter to Peter Carr laying out all of his plans for everything about state education from elementary on up. He drafts the petition they're going to send. He designs buildings for this new edifice, and he is very soon writing lots of letters to his intellectual friends for advice on how to start a proper university.
Which, of course, had been a dream of his for decades. He'd always been interested in education and had always been at least tangentially involved in efforts to create universities and colleges, and was always sort of seen as a source on the topic.
I think everybody knew he was a great advocate and resource in this area. I don't know exactly why it really takes up steam again in 1814, except that he wasn't able to pursue it while he was president, and now he's been out for a few years. And he later described this as the hobby of his old age, and he says at one point that if he could just be alive until the university opens its doors, he won't mind if he dies the next day. And, of course, he did achieve that.
Yeah. We're talking with Jeff Looney, the editor of the Retirement Papers of Thomas Jefferson. And if you just joined us, Volume 7 has been published. It covers the years, 1813 and part of 1814. I'm curious, we're going to take a break here in just a minute, but I'm curious to what extent we learn about, to what degree Jefferson was involved in the Madison administration. Was he and Madison, of course, talked regularly, but was he seen as a confidant or an advisor to the new president, James Madison, in Washington?
Jefferson was very careful not to give advice in really direct and obvious ways, and above all, not to be seen as giving advice, because he wanted to give Madison his own space. Nonetheless, people always assumed that he was kind of running things in the background, which I think both he and Madison found really annoying. But that doesn't change the fact that they were very, very good friends and associates. And whenever Madison comes home to relax for a few days, he almost always manages to get some time with Jefferson, and I think they talk that way. The letters show that Jefferson occasionally can't quite resist giving some advice, but it's always very diplomatically worded.
We'll continue our conversation with Jeff Looney, the editor of the Retirement Papers of Thomas Jefferson. Volume 7 has just been published. It includes 526 individual documents running from November of 1813 to September of 1814. As Jeff and his team go very carefully through all the documents leading up to Jefferson's passing in 1826. Let me ask you about the Library of Congress, because that took place during this period that you've just looked at. Remind us the series of events, and as I understand it, it was a lot more controversial than people might realize.
I said that Jefferson didn't want to believe that Washington had burned, but once he was persuaded that it had burned, almost the first thing he did was to write a letter to a friend of his in Washington asking that his offer to sell his library to the nation to replace the Library of Congress that had burned be presented to Congress. And what he said was he was willing to offer them his library. He describes it in great detail, and he says he's willing to sell them his library. He has a couple of conditions. One is it has to be Congress's price. They will decide how much to pay him. He doesn't want to haggle. He'll take whatever they offer him. But he does insist that they buy the whole thing. He regards it as a really important body of books, and he doesn't want to break it up for that purpose. He also wants to retain a few books for his own use, but he'll leave that up to Congress. Congress eventually does vote to set a price and to buy it, but it's actually rather controversial. There are some heated debates in Congress, and one of the votes is actually quite close as to whether they're going to buy it. Some of that is Federalist opposition, his political opponents who think this is just an attempt to give Jefferson some money in his retirement. Of course, there's no pensions at the time, so they suspect something's up that way. But they also object to the purchase because of the scope of Jefferson's library. They think they want to be able to pick and choose, and they want to kind of narrow it down. They don't want books on everything under the sun. And at least one of them objects that we don't need all these books in foreign languages, but congressmen don't know all these foreign languages anyway. And so they actually come fairly close at some points to defeating it. But the actual outcome is happy. They do buy the whole thing. And by doing that, they transform this library from a fairly small, very much legislature-type kind of oriented thing into a very broad collection attempting to capture all aspects of human knowledge. And in doing so, they transform the library from a small reference thing into a great cultural institution, which it's been ever since.
So it was that sale that really put it on the course to which it has become.
I think everybody thinks that, including the Library of Congress itself.
We're talking with Jeff Looney. It's 522. It's interesting that he said, I want to hang on to some of the books for my own use. And he's just at that time getting into designing a university. You would have thought he would have held on to his books of architecture, the Palladio that he had used for years, and I'm sure were well marked up and dog-eared. But he lost those and later had to borrow James Madison's books of architecture so that he could work on buildings for the University of Virginia.
Yeah, well, I think that there he was a victim of his own absolute unwillingness to haggle about anything, because he had said he hoped he could hold a few books and they would be turned over at his death. And they essentially ignored that, and he wouldn't bring it up again, you know. So I'm sure if he'd said again, you remember I said this in my letter.
Right.
Said, oh, yeah, we can hold those. But he wouldn't bring it up, and so eventually he had to send all of his books away.
How many volumes did it end up being?
Well, there were about 6,700 volumes. There's lots of different ways to count it, but that's our best number right now.
Here's one thing I've always been confused about. When you go to Monticello and you go on the tour there and you walk through his office and library there, where would he have kept all those thousands upon thousands of books? Were they just all throughout the house? Because they wouldn't all necessarily fit in the place in the library that we see today. There's, you know.
Yeah, we've tried to calculate. We know that the bookshelves he had were pretty much floor to ceiling. They would hold a lot of books, but there's no way I think they would have held it all. I personally believe that the attic and the second floor and maybe the dome room were all full of books by the time he sold. Of course, immediately he started buying more. He said he could not live without books, and he immediately proved it. I think he held out some of his purchase money from the nation specifically to buy more books with.
Yeah. We're talking with Jeff Looney, the editor of the Retirement Papers of Thomas Jefferson. Volume 7 has just been published. We're very excited about that and talking about it here for the first time. Jeff, there was a memoir that came out regarding George Washington that Jefferson wrote about and reflected upon. What was this about?
Well, Jefferson was asked by someone who was working on a book about Washington to give him his memories of Washington, and he produced a really, really eloquent, moving description of Washington from somebody who'd known him quite well, and they wound up being estranged. But you know, by this time, 15 years have passed since Washington died, And he wrote a really, really marvelous description, character sketch about Washington. And he commented on some things that he thought were weaknesses, but overall it was just really very, very moving. He says at one point about Washington, his integrity was most pure, his justice the most inflexible I have ever known, no motives of interest or consanguinity of friendship or hatred being able to bias his decision. He was indeed, in every sense of the word, a wise, a good, and a great man. And, you know, it's a marvelous thing. Unfortunately, at the time, this book didn't come out. So people had to wait a few more years until Jefferson's letters started coming out, actually, to read this this wonderful assessment of Washington.
It's also during this period where there's some mention of recruiting African-Americans to fight against the British in the War of 1812. And Jefferson had some commentary on that, right?
Well, he didn't. I don't know that he actually commented, but what we have in this volume we're printing is a letter from a man named Duane to Jefferson, a journalist who wrote Jefferson and said, I've got this idea that I think we should consider. And he writes this essay about how we should start recruiting black troops and that this would undermine the certainty that the British were going to come in and start trying to use American black troops against America. So he said, let's turn that against them and recruit our own. He knew, the guy writing Jefferson knew it would be controversial, and we don't know that Jefferson even responded, but certainly nothing came of it. But it was a remarkable suggestion at that time that anybody would have actually put that forward. The same volume we're printing actually has another letter where a man named Edward Coles, a remarkable man who subsequently became governor of Illinois, he writes to Jefferson and says, you know, in your retirement, you really ought to promote the cause of abolition of slavery yourself, Mr. Jefferson. And he explains that he himself is planning to leave the state and free all of his own slaves, and he does. Jefferson writes back and says, I'm too old. I have to leave this to the next generation. My prayers will be with you, but that's all an old man can give. But it's a remarkable exchange on both sides.
Yeah, and incredibly historic. And to a lot of modern readers, very disappointing that he, in his old age, he still wasn't continuing the fight. arguably a fight that he waged very strongly as a young man in the Virginia legislature, really taking on the slave trade, but in his old age, throwing his hands up.
Yeah, well, we're all, you know, all modern people are disappointed, but he's a man of his time. And certainly what he wanted more than anything at that stage of his life in many areas like this was peace and quiet. And he writes lots of letters where he says, you know, the thing I most want is to be left alone. And this was a good example, I think.
Volume 7 of the Retirement Papers of Thomas Jefferson, now available, published 526 individual documents chronicling the life of Jefferson from November of 1813 to September of 1814. Jeff Looney, the editor of the series, thank you so much for being here, Jeff.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.